The God Delusion by Richard Dawkins. Read by Richard Dawkins and Lalla Ward. In Memoriam, Douglas Adams, 1952 to 2001. Isn't it enough to see that a garden is beautiful without having to believe that there are fairies at the bottom of it too? Chapter 1. A Deeply Religious Non-Believer.
I don't try to imagine a personal God. It suffices to stand in awe at the structure of the world, insofar as it allows our inadequate senses to appreciate it. Albert Einstein.
Deserved respect. The boy lay prone in the grass, his chin resting on his hands. He suddenly found himself overwhelmed by a heightened awareness of the tangled stems and roots, a forest in microcosm, a transfigured world of ants and beetles, and even, though he wouldn't have known the details at the time, of soil bacteria by the billions, silently and invisibly shoring up the economy of the micro-world. Suddenly the microforest of the turf seemed to swell and become one with the universe, and with the rapt mind of the boy contemplating it. He interpreted the experience in religious terms, and it led him eventually to the priesthood. He was ordained an Anglican priest, and became a chaplain at my school, a teacher of whom I was fond. It is thanks to decent liberal clergymen like him that nobody could ever claim that I had religion forced down my throat. Our sport during lessons was to sidetrack him away from scripture and towards stirring tales of fighter command and the few. He had done war service in the RAF, and it was with familiarity and something of the affection that I still retain for the Church of England, at least by comparison with the competition, that I later read John Betjeman's poem.
Our padre is an old sky pilot. Severely now they've clipped his wings, but still the flagstaff in the rectory garden points to higher things.
In another time and place, that boy could have been me under the stars, dazzled by Orion, Cassiopeia and Ursa Major, tearful with the unheard music of the Milky Way, heady with the night scents of frangipani and trumpet flowers in an African garden. Why the same emotion should have led my chaplain in one direction and me in the other is not an easy question to answer. A quasi-mystical response to nature and the universe is common among scientists and rationalists. It has no connection with supernatural belief. Carl Sagan, in Pale Blue Dot, wrote,
"How is it that hardly any major religion has looked at science and concluded, this is better than we thought. The universe is much bigger than our prophets said, grander, more subtle, more elegant. Instead, they say, no, 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 my God is a little God, and I want him to stay that way. A religion, old or new, that stressed the magnificence of the universe as revealed by modern science, might be able to draw forth reserves of reverence and awe hardly tapped by the conventional faiths."
All Sagan's books touch the nerve endings of transcendent wonder that religion monopolized in past centuries. My own books have the same aspiration. Consequently, I hear myself often described as a deeply religious man. An American student wrote to me that she had asked her professor whether he had a view about me.
"Sure,"
he replied.
"He's positive. Science is incompatible with religion, but he waxes ecstatic about nature and the universe. To me, that is religion."
But is religion the right word? I don't think so. The Nobel Prize-winning physicist and atheist Steven Weinberg made the point as well as anybody in Dreams of a Final Theory.
"Some people have views of God that are so broad and flexible that it is inevitable that they will find God wherever they look for him. One hears it said that God is the ultimate, or God is our better nature, or God is the universe. Of course, like any other word, the word God can be given any meaning we like. If you want to say that God is energy, then you can find God in a lump of coal."
Weinberg is surely right that if the word God is not to become completely useless, it should be used in the way people have generally understood it, to denote a supernatural creator that is appropriate for us to worship.
Much unfortunate confusion is caused by failure to distinguish what can be called Einsteinian religion from supernatural religion. Einstein sometimes invoked the name of God, and he's not the only atheistic scientist to do so, inviting misunderstanding by supernaturalists eager to misunderstand and claim so illustrious a thinker as their own. The dramatic, or was it mischievous, ending of Stephen Hawking's A Brief History of Time,
"For then we should know the mind of God,"
is notoriously misconstrued. It has led people to believe, mistakenly of course, that Hawking is a religious man.
Great scientists of our time who sound religious usually turn out not to be so when you examine their beliefs more deeply. One of Einstein's most eagerly quoted remarks is,
"Science without religion is lame. Religion without science is blind."
But Einstein also said,
"It was, of course, a lie what you read about my religious convictions, a lie which is being systematically repeated. I do not believe in a personal God, and I have never denied this, but have expressed it clearly. If something is in me which can be called religious, then it is the unbounded admiration for the structure of the world so far as our science can reveal it."
Does it seem that Einstein contradicted himself? That his words can be cherry-picked for quotes to support both sides of an argument? No. By religion, Einstein meant something entirely different from what is conventionally meant. As I continue to clarify the distinction between supernatural religion on the one hand and Einsteinian religion on the other, bear in mind that I am calling only supernatural gods delusional. Here are two more quotations from Einstein to give a flavour of Einsteinian religion.
"I am a deeply religious non-believer. This is a somewhat new kind of religion. The idea of a personal God is quite alien to me and seems even naive."
In greater numbers since his death, religious apologists understandably try to claim Einstein as one of their own. Some of his religious contemporaries saw him very differently. In 1940, Einstein wrote a famous paper justifying his statement, "I do not believe in a personal God." This and similar statements provoked a storm of letters from the religiously orthodox, many of them alluding to Einstein's Jewish origins. The extracts that follow are taken from Max Jammer's book, Einstein and Religion, which is also my main source of quotations from Einstein himself on religious matters. The Roman Catholic Bishop of Kansas City said,
"It is sad to see a man who comes from the race of the Old Testament and its teaching deny the great tradition of that race."
Other Catholic clergymen chimed in.
"There is no other God but a personal God. Einstein does not know what he's talking about. He's all wrong. Some men think that because they have achieved a high degree of learning in some field, they're qualified to express opinions in all."
The notion that religion is a proper field in which one might claim expertise is one that should not go unquestioned. That clergyman presumably would not have deferred to the expertise of a claimed fairyologist on the exact shape and colour of fairy wings. Both he and the bishop thought that Einstein, being theologically untrained, had misunderstood the nature of God. On the contrary, Einstein understood very well exactly what he was denying. An American Roman Catholic lawyer working on behalf of an ecumenical coalition wrote to Einstein,
"We deeply regret that you made your statement in which you ridicule the idea of a personal God. In the past 10 years, nothing has been so calculated to make people think that Hitler had some reason to expel the Jews from Germany as your statement. Conceding your right to free speech, I still say that your statement constitutes you as one of the greatest sources of discord in America."
A New York rabbi said,
"Einstein is unquestionably a great scientist, but his religious views are diametrically opposed to Judaism."
But, why not and? The president of a historical society in New Jersey wrote a letter that so damningly exposes the weakness of the religious mind.
"We respect your learning, Dr. Einstein, but there is one thing you do not seem to have learned, that God is a spirit and cannot be found through the telescope or microscope, no more than human thought or emotion can be found by analysing the brain. As everyone knows, religion is based on faith, not knowledge. Every thinking person, perhaps, is assailed at times with religious doubt. My own faith has wavered many a time. But I never told anyone of my spiritual aberrations for two reasons. One, I feared that I might, by mere suggestion, disturb and damage the life and hopes of some fellow being. Two, because I agree with the writer who said, "There is a mean streak in anyone who will destroy another's faith." I hope, Dr. Einstein, that you were misquoted and that you will yet say something more pleasing to the vast number of the American people who delight to do you honour.
What a devastatingly revealing letter. Every sentence drips with intellectual and moral cowardice. The one thing all his theistic critics got right was that Einstein was not one of them. He was repeatedly indignant at the suggestion that he was a theist. So was he a deist, like Voltaire and Diderot, or a pantheist, like Spinoza, whose philosophy he admired.
I believe in Spinoza's God, who reveals himself in the orderly harmony of what exists, not in a God who concerns himself with fates and actions of human beings.
Let's remind ourselves of the terminology. A theist believes in a supernatural intelligence who, in addition to his main work of creating the universe in the first place, is still around to oversee and influence the subsequent fate of his initial creation. A deist, too, believes in a supernatural intelligence, but one whose activities were confined to setting up the laws that govern the universe in the first place. Pantheists don't believe in a supernatural God at all, but use the word God as a non-supernatural synonym for nature, or for the universe, or for the lawfulness that governs its workings. Deists differ from theists in that their God does not answer prayers, is not interested in sins or confessions, does not read our thoughts, and does not intervene with capricious miracles. Deists differ from pantheists in that the deist God is some kind of cosmic intelligence, rather than the pantheist's metaphoric or poetic synonym for the laws of the universe. Pantheism is sexed-up atheism. Deism is watered-down theism. There is every reason to think that famous Einsteinisms like "God is subtle, but he's not malicious," or "He does not play dice," or "Did God have a choice in creating the universe?" are pantheistic, not deistic, and certainly not theistic. "God does not play dice" should be translated as "Randomness does not lie at the heart of all things." "Did God have a choice in creating the universe?" means, could the universe have begun in any other way? Einstein was using God in a purely metaphorical, poetic sense. So is Stephen Hawking, and so are most of those physicists who occasionally slip into the language of religious metaphor. I wish that physicists would refrain from using the word God in their special metaphorical sense. The metaphorical or pantheistic God of the physicists is light years away from the interventionist, miracle-wreaking, thought-reading, sin-punishing, prayer-answering God of the Bible, of priests, mullahs, and rabbis, and of ordinary language. Deliberately to confuse the two is, in my opinion, an act of intellectual high treason. Undeserved respect. My title, The God Delusion, does not refer to the God of Einstein and the other enlightened scientists of the previous section. That is why I needed to get Einsteinian religion out of the way to begin with. It has a proven capacity to confuse. In the rest of this book, I am talking only about supernatural gods, of which the most familiar, to the majority of my readers, will be Yahweh, the God of the Old Testament. I shall come to him in a moment, but before leaving this preliminary chapter, I need to deal with one more matter that would otherwise bedevil the whole book. A widespread assumption, which nearly everybody in our society accepts, the non-religious included, is that religious faith is especially vulnerable to offence and should be protected by an abnormally thick wall of respect, in a different class from the respect that any human being should pay to any other. Douglas Adams put it so well in an impromptu speech made in Cambridge shortly before his death, that I never tire of sharing his words.
Religion has certain ideas at the heart of it which we call sacred or holy or whatever. What it means is, here is an idea or a notion that you're not allowed to say anything bad about. You're just not. Why not? Because you're not. If somebody votes for a party that you don't agree with, you're free to argue about it as much as you like. Everybody will have an argument, but nobody feels aggrieved by it. If somebody thinks taxes should go up or down, you're free to have an argument about it. But on the other hand, if somebody says, I mustn't move a light switch on a Saturday, you say, I respect that. Why should it be that it's perfectly legitimate to support the Labour Party or the Conservative Party, Republicans or Democrats, this model of economics versus that, Macintosh instead of Windows, but to have an opinion about how the universe began, about who created the universe? No, that's holy. We are used to not challenging religious ideas, but it's very interesting how much of a furore Richard creates when he does it. Everybody gets absolutely frantic about it, because you're not allowed to say these things. Yet when you look at it rationally, there's no reason why those ideas shouldn't be as open to debate as any other, except that we have agreed somehow between us that they shouldn't be.
Here's a particular example of our society's overweening respect for religion, one that really matters. By far the easiest grounds for gaining conscientious objector status in wartime are religious. You can be a brilliant moral philosopher with a prize-winning doctoral thesis expounding the evils of war, and still be given a hard time by a draft board evaluating your claim to be a conscientious objector. Yet, if you can say that one or both of your parents is a Quaker, you sail through like a breeze, no matter how inarticulate and illiterate you may be on the theory of pacifism or indeed Quakerism itself.
At the opposite end of the spectrum from pacifism, we have a pusillanimous reluctance to use religious names for warring factions. In Northern Ireland, Catholics and Protestants are euphemised to nationalists and loyalists, respectively. The very word religions is bowdlerised to communities, as in inter-community warfare. Here's another weird example of the privileging of religion. On the 21st of February 2006, the United States Supreme Court ruled that a church in New Mexico should be exempt from the law, which everybody else has to obey, against the taking of hallucinogenic drugs. Faithful members of the Centro Espírita Beneficiente Unyayo do Vegetal believed that they can understand God only by drinking Hoasca tea, which contains the illegal hallucinogenic drug dimethyltryptamine. Note that it is sufficient that they believe that the drug enhances their understanding. They do not have to produce evidence. Conversely, there is plenty of evidence that cannabis eases the nausea and discomfort of cancer sufferers undergoing chemotherapy. Yet the Supreme Court ruled in 2005 that all patients who use cannabis for medicinal purposes are vulnerable to federal prosecution, even in the minority of states where such specialist use is legalized. Religion, as ever, is the trump card. Imagine members of an art appreciation society pleading in court that they believe they need a hallucinogenic drug in order to enhance their understanding of impressionist or surrealist paintings. Yet when a church claims an equivalent need, it is backed by the highest court in the land. Such is the power of religion as a talisman.
I am not in favour of offending or hurting anyone just for the sake of it. But I am intrigued and mystified by the disproportionate privileging of religion in our otherwise secular societies. As H. L. Mencken said,
we must respect the other fellow's religion, but only in the sense and to the extent that we respect his theory that his wife is beautiful and his children smart.
It is in the light of this unparalleled presumption of respect for religion that I make my own disclaimer for this book. I shall not go out of my way to offend, but nor shall I don kid gloves to handle religion any more gently than I would handle anything else.